Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. On today's show, as the state continues to evolve the vaccine rollout with equity now as its top priority, we check in with smaller counties and underserved urban communities to find out how vaccination rates and access are faring. Also, a look at the so-called California exodus and what new numbers now show. And an update on California's push to end shifting the clocks twice a year, something that will take place again this weekend. But first, California State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Thurmond was elected by voters in 2018. And according to the California Department of Education's website, he is responsible for the education of more than 6 million children across more than 10,000 schools statewide. Many students are approaching a full year without stepping foot inside the classroom. We spoke with the superintendent yesterday, Tony Thurmond, and started off with where things stand with school reopenings and how he envisions the rest of this current school year closing out.
It's been a very difficult year. I have tremendous respect for the resilience of our students and their parents and our educators and administrators. This has been tough. I think that for an education system, we have to acknowledge that this isn't how our system was built. And we've been tested at every turn out of necessity to keep kids safe. And in the fall, I think almost every school moved into distance learning. And we've seen some be able to get open. We've seen others struggle to do so. And we know that even though distance learning was a way to keep kids safe, especially when you think about underlying health conditions, there are unavoidable learning gaps that students have experienced, higher rates of depression and needs for social emotional learning. As you say all that, I feel like we're in a place, even though we still have some counties that are in purple, some in deep purple, we're seeing lower COVID transmissions. We're seeing schools really get moving quickly on opening dates. Many are really scrambling to try and meet the state's goal for April 1. It seems as though many are working towards mid-April. Some have gotten open. Some have even stayed open since the fall in some of our rural communities for sure and other places. And so I would just say that right now there is the CDC has given us new guidelines and new research that I think shows a path for how schools can get open. And we've looked at that. And we've also started talking more about the role that we think COVID testing can play for helping schools get open. There's some good signs, right? 200,000 educators in the state have received the vaccine. That's significant.
Out of how many?
200,000.
Out of how many?
Oh, well, that actually represents largely what's considered the early elementary school workforce. And so, most people were saying that was the magic number that we thought needed to happen in terms of vaccines. So it was about 200,000. And we're seeing signs that the vaccine doses are going to accelerate. And so we can get you a better number of the total number of adult staff. But 200,000 was considered a key number to be able to start phasing schools back. And so that's helpful. Today, we did a webinar for school districts so that they would know about rapid COVID testing and the role that that plays in helping to keep schools open once they are open. And we have three schools that we manage directly for deaf and blind students. And we're using rapid COVID testing to make that happen. We're working on a plan to get our schools open by mid-April. There's probably about 300,000 teachers total in the state, but that number doesn't include all school staff, like classified staff, custodians, and others who, but the number of 200,000 was a key number that everyone was striving to get. And so obviously it's been a tough year, but, there are things happening. The state's giving more resources for COVID testing. There's more vaccines, and so we see a path to getting schools open and we see our schools literally racing to be able to get open for the rest of the school year.
Superintendent, you talked a little bit there about how not everyone learns the same, and nor did they have, equal, access to the tools they needed during the COVID pandemic. You recently announced guidelines that address grading student
progress and the ongoing issue of equity and distance and hybrid learning. Walk us through how these would work. Are districts required to follow these guidelines?
Every district sets their own grading policy. That continues to be the case. This is a local control state as it relates to education. So districts have their own guidelines for grading. What we've seen is that, by and large, students have struggled in distance learning. I think some of that stems from the fact that we went into distance learning ill-prepared. Again, our system just wasn't built for that. And teachers didn't get training. We knew that when we went in, a million students didn't have a computer at home. Maybe now still a million students without access to the internet. And so in the fall, as our districts were racing to get open started to open in distance learning, I started a task force on closing the digital divide. First, so that we could respond to the need for more devices. We moved probably 100,000 computers and hotspots and other internet-enabled devices across the state. We got donations in the millions. But it just isn't enough. We've decided that we're going to use this task force to try and close the digital divide once and for all. It shouldn't exist. California's got the resources, a lot of technology. There's no reason for us to have the digital divide. So I used that task force to really put pressure on internet service providers to say, we need you to provide free internet for those who qualify. And they essentially provided internet at $10 a month for many of our families, with no hoops, with no bells and whistles, make it easy to sign up, provide staff who speak other languages to get people signed up. We made that a priority because we could see that how do you learn in distance learning when you don't have one of the main tools to learn, a computer? And so there's still a lot of work to do, but our latest thing is we've announced this innovation challenge where we're gonna give $1 million cash prize to someone who helps us come up with a way to get broadband figured out for the state. Any innovator, entrepreneur, researcher can participate. We just see that this gap has been here for a long time. We want to accelerate our efforts to close the digital gap.
Yeah, so that's the problem. How is the grading going to address it?
I don't know that it does. I would just say that many districts have made the decision to not give failing grades to students. Districts have the ability to make decisions about pass-fail grades or to take traditional letter grades. The guiding was not intended to, it's just intended to give some guidance for districts about how to think about it. That the key, what's going to help offset learning gaps is what we do. And we've been giving support to the field since the fall on, through webinars, of course, on how distance learning can be maximized. And talking about things like providing tutoring supports to students. We've been talking about providing social emotional learning. We literally brought the providers who do counseling and social emotional learning on a webinar for our districts to see who can provide those resources to them. These are the things that are going to help to close the learning gap. There's going to have to be tutoring for students. There's going to have to be coaching for teachers, professional development. Summer school creates an opportunity for our students, but that means preparing now. And I'm actually pulling together educators and administrators and the legislators to plan out what summer could look like, because there are proposals in the legislature to fund additional staff to build out a robust summer program. I just think it would be a mistake for any of our school districts to wait until the summer to think that's the way we're going to accelerate learning. We have to start that now. We actually can start that now in person or in distance learning. I believe those are the tools that are going to help us accelerate learning.
So Laura Rosen wrote an article for Cal Matters last week that had the headline, "Where is Tony Thurman? State schools chief stays behind the scenes in school reopening debate." Is that a fair description? How much of a role did you play in helping to broker the current deal that the state has to reopen?
Just going back to December, I've worked closely with the governor to make, recommendations for adding more COVID testing and funding for school districts to do COVID testing, because I could see our school districts were struggling to figure out how to get open without it. And so I started making recommendations to the governor that there'd be weekly COVID testing, but the funding to provide to districts. And that's essentially the centerpiece of the governor's proposal that he submitted in early January that ultimately became what we call AB 86. And it has in it as a centerpiece rapid COVID testing. It has in it also things that I proposed to the governor and others. As I said, these learning acceleration plans, but districts need those resources. And so, you know, I disagree with the title of that story. The reality is that we're a local control state and school districts, we have 1,000 school districts. They all have elected school boards and they all have superintendents and they make their own decisions about when they open and how they open. But here's the thing. My job gives me the opportunity to amplify what they need, to get the messages to legislators and to the governor, because my job really gives me the ability to work on their behalf to get resources. You know, I cherish that. And I've worked closely with this governor, with the members, the leaders and members of the legislature, with superintendents of many districts to hear what their concerns are, to go and work with policymakers about getting the resources to school districts. I understand that many may not understand that my role, they may assume that my role is I have a button to push for school districts to make a decision. We don't have that, you know, as that's just not part of the authority that I have.
It's far more local, right, in California?
It's all local. It's all local. It's all local decision making. But, you know, I have really tried to work with every district to the best I can by reaching out to them, writing guidance to them, taking their questions, like what we did today. We put on a webinar for every single district to figure out how they can get rapid COVID testing. We're brokering getting the resources to them. We're finding money to help them. And so that's the way it works in California. But I get it. Parents have the right to be frustrated. This is confusing and difficult. But the reality is that I'm doing all that I can and going even beyond the tools that I'm given. And I'll never stop doing that until we figure out a way to help all of our kids get the best education that they can, until we help all our schools get open in person.
We don't have a lot of time left, so I do want to get to this question. And last year, you requested the state set up guidelines for ethnic studies curriculum for high schools. An editorial this week in the LA Times says it's controversial, a little sloppy, but much improved. Help us understand what it is you're hoping to see at the end of this process and where we are now.
This has been a long road coming. The legislature, going back many years, has called for the creation of ethnic studies, and actually was in the legislature and had a chance to vote in support of creating ethnic studies. The curriculum has been a long path to build, but what you're going to find now, if you look at it, is a very robust guide that speaks to the experience of communities of color in a way that it helps students from those communities to have strong self-esteem, and it allows students from all backgrounds to be proud of the accomplishments of people of color. It has a very robust section on what many people consider to be core ethnic studies, the focus of African American students, Latinx students, Asian American, Pacific Islander students, and Native American students. And we have gone through and fine-tuned all the lesson plans and the discussion about those groups and their contributions. We've also recognized that even though there is a core ethnic studies, this is a unique moment in time where since 2016, we've seen a high increase in acts of hate all across the nation. And for those reasons, we've added an appendix that allows us to speak to and bridge to the experience of other groups that, while they're not part of core ethnic studies, they have experienced oppression. Their stories need to be told. There are groups that have experienced hate. This gives us a chance to address anti-Semitism directly, and there are lesson plans to do that. This gives us a chance to address the experience of the Armenian genocide or the Sikh community of Arab Americans. We've even put on our own mini series on ethnic studies to introduce ethnic studies to students. We've done that against the backdrop of the killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And we created a youth advisory council so that we could have students introduce ethnic studies to other students from the standpoint of a young person's perspective. What I'm seeing is now we're in a position for the state board to approve the curriculum, which is just that. It's a guide for school districts to use. But at the same time, the legislature is considering AB 101, a bill that would make ethnic studies a graduation requirement. This creates an opportunity for our schools. And I'm sponsoring that legislation as state superintendent. The key is that in our state budget now, there are proposals that would send resources to the local school districts for how to implement ethnic studies. A statewide guide without those resources, you know, it may not allow for full implementation. But giving resources for training and coaching at the district level is critical. I would just say that we've also paired with all of that, this Education to End Hate series that we put on, that we've sought grants to give direct training to districts on anti-racism kind of work and how we can use education to counter hate in our communities and in our schools.
Finally, Superintendent, the state talks about regaining learning loss as a top priority. But parents are concerned, rightfully, that you can't get that crucial development time back. What would you say to them?
You know, parents have a right to be concerned. And we're working with educator groups and equity groups and legislators, you know, because we see that there are gaps that have been exacerbated during the pandemic. We were already working before the pandemic on strategies to close what's called the achievement gap. And we know that those learning gaps have been exacerbated during the pandemic. You know, I would just say, again, we know that this is tough, but districts needed to be in distance learning to keep families safe. You know, people took issue with saying things like you have to wear a mask. And we helped to move masks and PPE to 10,000 schools in this state so that when it was time to open, they'd have the resources. But these are the things that we have to do. People are upset. They said, why couldn't we have sports? But everything the CDC told us is if you have sports or in-person gatherings, it would be unsafe. And so now that we have new guidance from the CDC that there are safe ways to reopen, we're moving to do that. And we will work to help our students offset learning gaps. Students are always learning. This wasn't ideal, but they're always learning. This was not wasted time. And we'll work with them. Teachers will do what they've always done. Assess where students enter when they come back, assess where they are, help to guide enrichment, and we'll be working with our state legislature and governor to get more resources to our school districts to provide the kind of enrichment that will allow students to accelerate their learning to offset some of those learning gaps.
California State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tony Thurman, thank you so much for giving us an update on where things stand.
Thank you.
And again, that conversation was recorded yesterday afternoon. He did mention today a couple of times, so just note, that was actually yesterday. Up next, as the state pushes for vaccine equity, we check in with rural communities and urban neighborhoods most hard hit by the pandemic to see how they're faring as the rollout evolves. You're listening to Insight here on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. You know, it can be hard to keep up with California's vaccine rollout as state public health officials continue to fine-tune and evolve where the doses go, with equity now top of mind. But with 58 counties, large and small throughout the state, equity can carry different meanings. And there still is the outlier of hesitancy for hard-hit communities, skeptical that they are now being prioritized for the vaccine. We're going to start off right now a little more than an hour northeast of Sacramento in Nevada County. Ryan Groover is the County Health and Human Services Director and joins us today to help us understand the unique needs and challenges the county is facing to ramp up vaccination rates. Thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Hi, Randall. Thank you so much for having me on today.
So first off, every county is unique in size and demographic. Can you briefly paint a picture of Nevada County for us?
Yeah, Nevada County is a rural county that touches the Nevada border and then comes all the way down to border Placer County in Auburn. We have around 100,000 people in Nevada County. Population is disproportionately elderly compared to the rest of the state, which means disproportionately vulnerable to COVID-19. So we have double the state's percentage of people over the age of 65. The state is at 14%. Nevada County, a county of 100,000. That means we have 28,000 people over the age of 65 and currently eligible for vaccine based on their age.
And the population centers are Truckee, Nevada City, Grass Valley?
That's correct. Those are the incorporated jurisdictions. Absolutely.
So it's spread out.
Yeah, it's quite geographically diffuse, and that is one of our challenges. And certainly is a distinction. But when we start to talk about equity, we don't necessarily have concentrated areas where we can do mass vaccination clinics to reach our underserved communities because they're dispersed throughout our rural jurisdiction. And so we have to get more creative with that. And that's something that I think is a unique challenge in jurisdictions like ours.
Where's the creativity going in that direction? What are you thinking in order to make that successful?
Yeah, so we have developed what we call the REACH team. It's the Resources for Equity and Access in Community Health. And it is basically a mobile vaccine team that's going out and targeting groups that have difficulty accessing vaccine through the normal channels. Another thing that we struggle with in Nevada County is the digital divide. And we have large swaths of our community that don't have access to broadband. We have even large swaths of our community that don't have cellular service. And so the primary means of accessing vaccine in the state, we've heard a lot of talk about things like MyTurn, and there are a lot of people in our community that can't access those things through the normal channels. And so we have to be more proactive, and our REACH team is a key part of that.
Ryan, how would you describe the vaccination rates currently? How's the county doing?
So we're doing pretty well. When the state initially announced eligibility for people over 65, as I mentioned, that's disproportionately high number of people in Nevada County. Yeah. That also happened to be in a week when we received an allocation of just 100 doses. And so there was this enormous expectation among people who were eligible and rightly felt they should be able to get an appointment, and a discrepancy between that and the amount of vaccine that was available. That has changed significantly to now we're receiving, I believe this week, around 5,000 doses. So that's obviously significantly better, but still we're at around 30,000 doses administered to Nevada County residents. And given that that's a two-dose vaccines, and we have approximately 40,000 people currently eligible when you take the age eligibility and all the other components of eligibility. And so we still have a ways to go just to get through the people that are currently eligible with the supply we currently have.
You mentioned that one week you got a distribution of 100 vaccines. Earlier this year in an interview with KCRA, you said there were some weeks Nevada County did not receive any vaccine allocation, zero. But it doesn't sound like that's still happening.
Yeah, and I think that was to be expected in the beginning when you had very little supply coming from the federal government. The state's passing on their allocations as they receive them. The real challenge with that was the discrepancy between the expectations that are created when you tell basically 40% of our community they're eligible and you are receiving very, very small amounts of vaccine. So that continues to be a challenge. We haven't gotten to the point where vaccine hesitancy is really the issue we're dealing with. It's still the overwhelming demand compared to the supply. But I will point out another area where we may struggle is that we're a community that has traditionally low vaccination rates. I believe we have the lowest percentage of school age vaccination in the state, and that's
the lowest in the state.
Correct. Uh-huh. And that's something that the public health department has been working on for years, and it's something that I'm very much expecting to rear its head as we move through this and get past the people that are so concerned right now and have enough supply. And I feel we're going to come to a time where we're going to have to really start doing that work of convincing people that this is what they need to do.
Yeah, and experts have been pointing to that statewide that we're quickly approaching a point where there will be more vaccine than there are people willing to take it. You really see that as a future problem for Nevada County.
I think particularly as we get to the younger, healthier populations, that uptake is going to be a key issue for us if we hope to have community immunity and return to normalcy.
What's the plan to overcome that?
So it's really about getting the message out to the people who are on the fence, and the people that I think we saw a lot early on, people sort of waiting to see with a new vaccine. And I think we're seeing some of that hesitancy start to fade away, and people that were sitting on the fence are starting to come around. And I think there's so much eagerness to get back to normal, and the vaccines are a ticket out of that, that I'm hopeful that we won't have as much of a challenge as we do with some of the other vaccines for diseases that to some people are something they read about but never experience directly, because vaccines have been so successful. Because we're all living with this, I'm hopeful that that will be sort of wind in our sails. But, you know, our public health department has a variety of tools and ways that they get to people who are vaccine hesitant.
Lately, Ryan, I've been trying to draw some good news or positive stories out of the guests when it comes to the pandemic, because we are starting to see that. We are seeing this shift. So I'm wondering, either in your professional or personal life there in Nevada County, what have you witnessed that is really encouraging as we round this corner?
Yeah, I mean, I think the vaccine rollout has both been frustrating for a lot of people because there's so little supply, but it's also to see the people that have been waiting, that have been doing the right thing to protect themselves and their neighbors and staying isolated for so long, and the emotions that come with getting that first dose and finally being here is very exciting and palpable for people. And we've had people break down in tears of joy just to get to this moment. And so it's been extremely rewarding. We've collaborated with partners to stand up a mass vaccination clinic that operates throughout the week with high volumes. And that's been a great success, where we're seeing that positive emotion day in and day out because of our fantastic team, who has really had the best brought out in them by this pandemic.
As the County Health and Human Services Director, is there anything over the past year that you wish you could have done had you had more resources, or is there any sort of lessons that you've learned that you plan to put in place in the months and years to come?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many lessons that we've learned over the past year. I think in the run up to, or in your introduction to this program today, you talk a lot about equity. And I think the pandemic has just highlighted so many problems that we had in our society for so long. COVID has brought them into focus. And I think we need to learn the correct lessons from this and not let it happen again. It seems like many are determined to learn the wrong lessons out of this. And I think it's very important that we bring the focus to public health and preparing and building up our systems for the next pandemic, because we can't let some of the negative experiences and negative politics that have come out of this hamstring us for the next one.
Yeah. Well, we always like to check in on all the counties that fall under the Cap Radio umbrella, and Nevada County is a big one. So thank you so much. We really appreciate you spending time with us this morning, and good luck on getting all those vaccines out.
Oh, thank you very much.
That is Ryan Groover, the Nevada County Health and Human Services Director. Let's continue our conversation now about vaccination rates, focusing on the issue of overcoming hesitancy that we just touched on a bit, and building trust with communities hardest hit during the pandemic, and frankly, well before. Barry Axios is with Voice of the Youth, a Sacramento-based nonprofit embedded with some of the most underserved communities. Barry, we really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us today. Great to see you again. Barry, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, terrific. Great. Great to see you again.
No doubt.
So the state is now targeting vaccines for zip codes hardest hit during the pandemic, whether contracting COVID or being financially devastated due to the pandemic. From what you're gathering, how are people in these neighborhoods feeling about being prioritized for the vaccine?
Hesitant. There's a split. Some of the older folks, they want it. They feel that they need it. You often hear that this idea of a vaccine redlining for some. But then there's a lot of us, me included in that, are like, no way. Like, why us now? why the sense of urgency, understanding the history that has been plagued by, you know, America to African Americans, the medical apartheid, when you talk about the syphilis experiment and you talk about multiple different things, even in these communities, when you look at these communities, we've been riddled with poverty, food deserts, and that all of a sudden you want to come have this miracle needle to wipe away this COVID-19. The hesitation is very real in our communities.
Barry, you do see, you know, millions of shots being distributed throughout the United States and around the globe. Does that not give you insurance that it's okay to get the vaccine?
But we also have seen that has not also been reported as much. A lot of people getting sick, a lot of people dying. And I just think that we need more time to really evaluate. And
Wait. A lot of people dying from getting the vaccine?
Yes, people dying.
What's your source on that?
It comes on in the news. It doesn't get all of the attention, but you hear folks that are dying from the vaccine. Now, I can't sit there and pinpoint if it's the actual vaccine, but you've seen a lot of headlines saying after a person that took the second vaccine, the first vaccine, that they've died. Or that you don't really necessarily know the reality of that. But these are the things that we are seeing. Just as much as people are saying that folks are getting the vaccine, we're also seeing a different side of that. So I think that for a lot of us, understanding that we should have a choice in what we want to do with our own bodies.
Yeah.
A lot of people
and you
have
do.
Been utilized.
You're not being ordered to take the vaccine. It's being more readily available.
Hold on a second. I wouldn't say ordered, but the way that the advertisement has become for this vaccine is almost telling. I saw this recent advertisement that said, almost like, take the shot so I can hug you and be around you again.
Right.
What does that mean? So is that telling me that if I don't take the shot, I can't hug my loved ones? Or CDC just basically said, well, those who are vaccinated, this is what you can do. Those who are not vaccinated, well, I mean, it's already creating a divide. So it's almost making me feel like, well, maybe I should get vaccinated because I can't hug my loved ones or I can't be around people, when we should still be able to have a choice. They're taking away choice slowly but surely. And I'm not really for that. A lot of people are not for that.
So,
to be honest with you.
So you brought up the syphilis experiment, the painful history of Tuskegee as a reason for mistrust. We do have a link at capradio.org/insight to an NPR code switch story about this experiment and how it relates to vaccine hesitancy, which may surprise you because in polling taken, Tuskegee was far down the list. It was more about a distrust of the medical system in the United States. Would you agree with that based on the people that you've come in contact with?
Like I said, the basic mistrust with government, period. The multiple problems that we have in these communities, when, like I said earlier, food deserts, we're talking about poverty, we're talking about crime, and all of a sudden the fix that you have is a needle. And there's been never close to near the investment that we have been screaming out loud about to these communities. And now all of a sudden you have this miracle needle that's going to fix everything or fix this COVID problem. I think the mistrust comes from just how the government has treated African Americans, period, throughout history, regardless of a syphilis experiment. We're looking at police brutality. We're looking at the genocide when it comes to the drugs. We're looking at mass incarceration. How do you all of a sudden go from a summer when we were protesting against injustice and turn around and say, hey, give us a needle? That's how some of us are looking at this. Like, you just made us push an issue to have you say, finally, well, maybe Black Lives Matter. And now you're going to turn around and say, well, about that Black Lives Matter, here's a needle to help COVID-19, when a lot of us are looking at you side-eye saying, we don't even believe how this COVID-19 even propelled into such the way it has. Not saying COVID-19 is not real, but the way it's been conducted, the mismanagement of our government handling it from the first place. You have communities that have no health care programming, no health care facilities, but yet you're going to be able to give a few organizations money to hold these testing facilities and hold these facilities where we can get a shot, but we don't have any health care facilities at all. That just doesn't make any sense to me.
Barry, do you plan on getting the vaccine?
No, I don't. I didn't take the flu shot. My immune system is good. I've gone through a whole year where I haven't been able, haven't got COVID. I've traveled. I've been in different places. I've helped my community. I've served.
So you've been lucky.
I've been lucky. Well, I don't know if I've been lucky. I just, in order for us, I think sometimes, and this is what African Americans have to really look at it, and sometimes we have to be ready instead of always getting ourselves prepared. I think a lot of this stuff is reactionary conditions that we constantly are involved in instead of being ready and prepared for moments like this. Like, the healthcare system in America should be something that we look at, especially here in one of the most wealthiest states in the world, California, that we shouldn't even have this issue to where people like myself are kind of pushing back against something that we should be able to trust because the healthcare system is intact. So I'm not.
What would make you trust the vaccine?
When I see more investments in the communities outside of just giving us a needle, some investments in these communities that will help these communities strive.
But that's going to be years.
But no, I can't sit there and say years, because at the end of the day, when I see this stimulus package being rolled out, if they want to make the investment the way they need to make the investment, they would make the investment. There's no profit in helping people of poor people. There's no profit in helping people of color unless there's some type of tag behind it. Right. And it's not.
Barry,
so I'm not going
to
do it.
I hate to cut it off here.
It's all good.
We have some pre-recorded stuff coming up, and it's a hard window. I can't escape it. I've actually already gone past the point that I was supposed to. So
thank
Barry
you.
Axios is with Voice of the Youth.
Enjoyed
speaking with you, but I think there's some fact checking we're going to have to do on that last segment.
No, please do.
There.
I'm just saying that these are the reports that are being put out there.
Right.
I'm not saying what it is.
Barry, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. We're back in just a moment. And welcome back to
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. The past year has uprooted and shifted around work life. The office for many took a back seat, became remote, and people began swapping out that expensive apartment in downtown for a spacious home outside the city and even moving out of state. But is talk of a California exodus really true? Natalie Holmes is a research fellow with the California Policy Lab at UC Berkeley and answers that very question with data. We spoke yesterday about her report, and I started by asking her, when it comes to the big question, has COVID caused a mass exodus from the state? And asked her about what surprised her most about the findings.
So the top line finding is we're not seeing what I would describe as a mass exodus from the state. Exits from the state are up a little bit relative to last year, but not that much. On the other hand, entrances to the state have declined. The other thing,
I was just going to say, so fewer people coming into California, which balances out that, you know, inward outward sort of equation.
Exactly right. Yep. The other thing that was interesting, once we, you know, satisfied ourselves that we, you know, looked at that top line question, was we looked at regions and counties within the state to see if there were any shifts in population. And that's where we really do see an increase in exits. And a decline in entrances from and to, respectively, the Bay Area and especially San Francisco.
So people are moving, but they're moving within the state, not necessarily out of the state. Where are they headed? The Bay Area people, where do they most likely move? And I think I may know the answer to this, but I'm going to let you say it.
Sure. So most Bay Area folks remain in the Bay Area. San Francisco is the county that really, if you have a chance to see the report and look at those maps, it's bright red in terms of, increase in exits and decline in entrances. 80% of those people are staying in the state, and about two-thirds remain in the Bay Area. So they're staying pretty close to home for the most part.
Do they tend to move to counties in the Bay Area that are farther away from the San Francisco or San Jose core?
So we definitely saw a decline in movement to San Francisco, and then Santa Clara County also saw some of the largest net exits.
Mm-hmm. What about counties like Sacramento or the surrounding counties, you know, Placer, El Dorado and such?
Sure. So some of those counties further east than Sacramento, but in kind of the northern Sierra Nevada range, saw some of the largest percentage increases in people coming in from the Bay Area.
Mm, yeah. And we like early on, we were calling Truckee a Zoom town, you know, because people can go to, instead of just visiting for vacation, they can go and work there because everyone was remote. Is that what was driving it?
So that's a great question. I have a friend who did that, in fact, and I was able to visit a friend in Tahoe, you know, just briefly during the pandemic last year. It's still going on, of course. What we can't look at is the why. I think certainly that's one plausible explanation. I know, you know, again, from personal experience, and everyone seems to know somebody who's doing something like that.
Right. So what was your methodology? How did you track the movement of residents?
Sure. So California Policy Lab, where I work, was just bringing on board this cool new data set kind of right as the pandemic was hitting. It's a consumer credit panel. And so if you think about the information on your credit report, that's the kind of information that we have at quarterly frequency. Importantly, that includes some location information. So what we do with that data set is we define a move as if you switch zip codes across quarters. So we've got fairly frequent looks at where people are living and also fairly geographically granular. So what we were able to do is define those moves and then look at the start and end location to see, you know, where people were, what those flows were. So where they're starting, where they're ending up.
We heard some high profile people leaving the state. We heard of some high profile people leaving the state. Elon Musk moving the Tesla headquarters to Austin, Texas. You investigated whether the wealthiest taxpayers are moving out of state, mentioning just the top 0.5% of California taxpayers account for 40% of state income tax revenues, which can have a huge impact on the state's bottom line, as we've seen. So what were your findings there?
Sure. So one important caveat is that we can't look at wealth or income of individuals. And so the way that we tried to proxy for that is by looking at the 10% of wealthiest zip codes by median household income. And what we found there is that people who are living, who started the year living in those 10% of wealthiest zip codes compared to the bottom 90%, don't seem to have responded differently to the pandemic, right? So, you know, again, important caveat is we can't look at individual wealthy people. And, you know, given those stats that you threw out, the movement of just a few people could have a pretty large effect. But what our data show, and again, this is just, you know, a kind of a top level quick look at it, there doesn't seem to be a different response among people living in the state's wealthiest zip codes.
Yeah, and the surplus in the state budget also would indicate that the wealthiest people are still living here. Your report mentioned the data doesn't show whether these are temporary or permanent moves. What are the big unknowns from your research?
Sure. So I wish I could predict the future, but I can't. You know, we're able to see what happened during 2020, but it's, you know, it remains to be seen whether people will come back in. You know, some of those big drops that we've heard about in rents asked in San Francisco may very well attract people back in. But we don't know. It's possible that that person who moved out to Truckee to take, you know, Zoom meetings likes it there and decides to stay. So we just don't know. You know, I think some of these, some of the company's decisions to extend work from home indefinitely may factor into this. And when you think about the kinds of places that have lots of jobs that can be done remotely, those are the kinds of places that may see longer term changes, but we just don't know yet.
Yeah. Finally, what more are you going to do with this research? Are there other trends of interest you'd like to look into?
Sure. So one question we've gotten a lot of is, among the people leaving the state, where are they going? In this first cut, we didn't look at that, but that's something we can see in the data. And then again, we can't talk much about the why with this research. We just wanted to quantify the moves using this new data. And so I'd love to explore some of the push-pull factors, including housing costs. And then, of course, the past several years, pretty much the entire state has experienced horrible wildfires. And that's sort of an additional layer of disaster to think about on top of this.
Yeah. Natalie Holmes is a research fellow with the California Policy Lab at UC Berkeley. Thank you for sharing your data with us. I think it's fascinating. A lot of us who are here, who are thinking about leaving, who are not thinking about leaving, who are proud Californians, just find it fascinating, the different movements within the state.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. It's it feels good to be able to use this new data set to be able to say something timely and hopefully useful.
And before we go today, we want to touch on something that we'll all be experiencing this weekend, early Sunday morning to be exact, the switch back to daylight saving time. Wait, are we still doing that? You may be asking. I thought we voted on that back in 2018 with Prop 7, and it passed by nearly 60% to get rid of the time change. Well, you're right, we did, and it did. But that proposition was only the first step in the process. The next step was for it to go through the state legislature. There, it passed the assembly with the required two-thirds vote, but stalled in the state Senate. That version was to move to year-round daylight saving time. To get caught up with where we stand now, I reached out to Democratic Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez, who co-authored the original bill and helped to get the issue on the ballot. The other co-author, Assemblyman Canson Chu, is no longer in the legislature. So at this point, it's just Gonzalez carrying the torch to end the time change in California. She says, following that first bill,
we heard from a lot of scientists and a lot of people involved in medicine that said, actually, if we're going to do this, it is good to stop time change, but it's better to stick with standard time year round. That would be a lot easier for the state as well, because we could do it. We don't need the authority of Congress in order to do that.
So going with year-round standard time would be an easier path. It wouldn't require getting Congress involved. And we'd line up with Arizona. I asked the Assemblywoman whether she thinks, post-pandemic concerns, of course, a bill like this could get through both the Assembly and the Senate in California. And she says she's bullish that it can. She says the trick, though, this time around is getting consensus on which side of the clock to make permanent. Support, she says, for the concept is strong. It's the details that create the struggle.
Overwhelmingly, it passed on the ballot. Overwhelmingly, you have people saying they don't want time change. But because there's two options, it's really hard to get a two-thirds vote for one of the options. And we were really straightforward when we ran the initiative that we weren't putting our thumb on the scale of either daylight savings time or standard time. But everybody heard what they wanted to hear. So people who liked daylight savings time thought, yes, daylight savings time year round. And people who just didn't like time change thought standard time year round. And now we're a little bit in a pickle.
Yeah, so the issue is not dead, but it did suffer a setback. And we'll have to restart in the legislature when the timing is right. The part where California voters have their say, Gonzalez says that's already set. And the electorate was loud and clear. Hey, I want to quickly do a fact check on the previous segment we had with Barry Axios, where he mentioned the vaccine and deaths. A review of available clinical information by the CDC, including death certificates, autopsies, and medical records, revealed no evidence that vaccination contributed to patient deaths. We will put a link to that on the Cap Radio website at capradio.org/insight. And that is Insight for today. I'm Randall White. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday when we'll discuss domestic abuse and violence amid the pandemic and what's being done about it. Until then, make it a great day.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.